Okay, any noise from your balloon, I'll take it away, okay? Okay, so we're talking about more additions of alkenes. Today we'll talk about radicals, both at the beginning and at the end. In the middle we'll talk about electrophilic carbon adding to alkenes, about isoprenoids, and about polymer properties, if we get so far. So radical polymerization is in the book, and here you come a radical and an alkene, and it forms a bond, and another one forms a bond, another one forms a bond, forms a bond, forms a bond. Okay, now, at some point the chain may curve like that, and if it gets in that position, there's the possibility that once in a long while it will react with itself. So it could take this hydrogen away and make that radical, and then it could react to more alkenes, right? So when you try to make polyethylene by free radical polymerization, occasionally you'll get a four-carbon side chain from it biting back on itself. Now, that has an important implication for properties, because the chains can't pack together as tightly if they have these branches on them irregularly. Right? So that gives low-density polyethylene. Remember, we talked about Ziegler-Natta catalysis giving high-density polyethylene that was strictly linear because it didn't have the radicals and wouldn't bite back on itself. So low-density polyethylene is what you have, for example, in baggies and things like that. Now, you can have an important thing is how long the chains are. Okay? And you have some control over that. Properties like viscosity and melting point depend on how long the chain is. But you can control it by adding a reagent like carbon tetrachloride, which the radical can attack and take away a chlorine atom, leaving the trichloromethyl radical. But that radical, of course, can start up another chain. Right? So adding a reagent like carbon tetrachloride, which is called a chain transfer agent, changes the length of the polymers, but doesn't require new initiation. You still have the radical. It's still a chain reaction, right? But the physical molecular chains are shortened. Okay, now suppose the rate in the case of styrene, the phenyl-substituted ethylene, polymerizing. Suppose you have a certain rate for adding styrenes, certain rate constant, and a certain rate constant for that chain transfer reaction with carbon tetrachloride. In the case of styrene, that turns out to be about 1%. The rate constant for chain transfer is about 1/100th as big as the chain transfer for polymerization. Does that mean you'll get 1% as often chain transfer? Is the rate the same as the rate constant? Henry?
No.
Well, how do you change it? Right, so you can change the concentration. Now, if the termination is negligible, then the molecular length should be something like how fast you add things compared to how fast you change chains. Right, and you need the rate constant times the concentration. So by fiddling around with the concentration, in principle, you can get any length you want, right? You can get any length you want, but it's random, this thing. So you don't get always exactly the same length. You get some average length and then some shorter and some longer, depending on the randomness of this process. And that's called dispersity, how tightly focused the chain length is in a polymer. Monodisperse means you have just a single chain length, but then polydisperse means that it's broadened out, and that can be an important thing in polymer technology, is controlling the dispersity. You don't do it in the way we showed here. Okay. Now that's radicals. Now we're going to talk about using carbon electrophiles to attack an alkene. And we're talking about oligomerization and polymerization. Polymerization, you know what it is. Oligomerization comes from the word oligo, which means a few. So instead of making many, many, many things in a chain, you make just a few. Usually a few is more than two or three, but less than 100 or something like that. Okay, so you have oligomers. Okay, anyhow, using carbon electrophiles. Now, what do we have for carbon electrophiles? Where do you find a carbon with a very low LUMO on it? So it wants to get at electrons and stabilize them. How do you find a carbon that has a low LUMO? Yeah. Pi star of C-double bond C is, but it's not enough. You need more than that, it turns out. That's not enough to attack an alkene. If that were enough, then alkenes would just attack alkenes, right? So you need better than that.
A carbocation,
another idea? That's a great one. But it's the second one I'm going to show. I thought you'd come up with something else first. Don? Pardon me? A carbonyl isn't low enough either. No. Sinead, do you have an idea? No? Okay. Sigma star. Right, with something with a really good leaving group, right? Or R plus, as Mike said. Okay, so we're going to look at both of these, and first we'll look at the R plus, since that's the more potent one. So here's a really surprising reaction, I think. It's the addition of isobutane to isobutylene, so that the T-butyl group adds on one carbon and the H adds on the other. What seems wrong with this to you? Do you think that's a good reaction? Was that one you would predict? Why not, Henry?
Well, there's nothing special about
the normal alkane, isobutane, doesn't have any high HOMO or low LUMO to speak of. How's it going to do this reaction? Well, you see you have an acid catalyst. So what do you expect acid to do if you put it in here, H+, where's it going to go? Shirley, what do you think? What over here on the left could react with H+? Yeah, the alkene, okay. So, incidentally, this is to make this compound, which is sometimes called, that's its real name, but it's sometimes called isooctane. And that, when you see octane rating on gasoline, that was the original standard that was assigned 100 on the octane scale, was this isooctane. So this is an important reaction in petroleum refining. Okay, so we do this. Okay, now we got the T-butyl cation. Of course, you add to this carbon to make the more substituted cation. Now, what can that react with? Now we have our carbon electrophile, right? The carbon cation, a really low LUMO. What is there in the mixture that it could react with? Anybody got an idea? Mac, what do you say? We don't have much to go with. This is what we have. What's going to react with C plus? No, that won't react. See, that's a crummy reaction. Okay, what will react with C plus? Although we'll revisit that later. Okay. Could, but it would come off again. It's a really good leaving group. Yeah.
Could it be another C double bond C?
Ah, another one of those. Okay. So now we can do our reaction and get this. So we're almost there, right? What do we need still? We need another H in what form? A hydrogen atom? A proton? H plus? We need H minus. We need hydride. Now, where can we get hydride? That's where the isobutane comes in. Because the T-butyl cation is so stable, it's possible to do this hydrogen transfer, this hydride transfer. We already talked about rearrangement, where a hydrogen next door, a CH bond next door to a cation, the H can move across with its electrons. So that's an intramolecular hydride shift. This is an intermolecular hydride shift. Okay? And in fact, that was proved that this could happen. It's a pretty surprising reaction by your grandfather Bartlett in 1944. And it was considered very important by the petroleum industry because they didn't have any idea how to control this process. Okay, so when you do that, then that makes this a chain reaction. Because after the hydride is lost, we have T-butyl cation, which comes back here. And now that's the one that adds to give this purple. Right, and then another hydride transfer, and now we have the product we're talking about. Okay, but then it cycles around and around and around and does the addition, a cation addition. Okay, now, if you didn't have the isobutane there to be the hydride source, then you couldn't do these things. Then what would you expect to happen next? Mike? Do another alkene, right? So do the same thing again. Those two could go together to give this. Then what? Okay, et cetera, et cetera. Right? And you get polyisobutylene, which is called butyl rubber, the stuff that's made this way. And it has the interesting property that it, air doesn't permeate it. So guess what it's used for? Not balloons. Balloons are cheapo. They're not this. Where do you want to keep air in under high pressure? In tires. So this is important in lining tires or in making inner tubes in the old days when you didn't have tubeless tires. So that's an important process. So both of these involve C plus doing the addition to an alkene. Now, we said that R plus can do it, but this can also do it, sigma star. And now we're going to talk about these electrophiles in making things that are called terpenes and steroids, important biological molecules. First, they depend on this compound as a starting material, which is isopentenyl, as it's called, pyrophosphate. So this turns out to be a good leaving group. Okay, that's its role in life. Okay, so we'll abbreviate it as OPP, right? Now, the first thing that happens when you use isopentenyl pyrophosphate is to isomerize some of it, right? To get the more stable double bond position, the more substituted double bond position, and that's called dimethyl allyl. Remember, allyl is a carbon that has a double bond next to it. Okay, so that's dimethyl allyl, as it's informally called. Okay, now, let's look at something about allyl. N-propyl, the rate for an SN2 reaction, so displacing chloride by iodide in acetone solvent here, we'll call that rate 1, okay, for the iodide to attack this. To attack allyl, it's almost 100 times faster. So having dimethyl allyl makes this a great place to react for SN2. Okay? In fact, if it were a phenyl group instead, it's more than 200 times faster. Okay? So it appears that having this unsaturation next to the carbon that's going to be pentavalent in the transition state somehow stabilizes it and therefore speeds up the reaction. Yeah. Yeah, presumably. I mean, somehow the HOMO or the LUMO here, the pi or pi star, has stabilizing interaction, especially when this is in the transition state, when these bonds are half formed. That's not too surprising. I'm not sure I would have predicted it, but who knows what would have happened under those curious bonding circumstances. But at any rate, it makes it fast. Of course, it's fast in SN1. If you were just losing the chloride and generating that cation, you know it would be very fast. But the interesting thing is it's fast in SN2 as well. Okay. So now we have this compound, which is such a compound, an allylic group with a leaving group on it. Okay, so now what's going to do the attacking? Right? The alkene HOMO can do the SN2 reaction. Or, viewed another way, it's this sigma star vacant orbital here that's attacking the alkene. Because we're talking about attacks on alkene by electrophiles. So we can view it as this attacking this, in which case it's SN2, or we can view it as this attacking this, in which case it's a carbon electrophile attacking an alkene. Okay? At any rate, that happens and you get this cation. And that cation can lose a proton to get this. Now, he could have lost a proton here as well. But bear in mind that these things are happening in biological systems. These are natural products. So other things around and about are controlling the structure of these and where the base can come up and so on. So it gives this compound, and that one's called geranyl pyrophosphate. Not because it's geriatric, it's because geraniol, the stuff that you get if this is OH, is the odor of geraniums. Okay? So that, notice that the starting thing was C5. The isopentenyl was C5. This is now, how many carbons in it? Can you tell me immediately? Without counting? It's the reaction of two of them. So it's C10. Right? Okay? Now, then we take geranyl pyrophosphate, and isomerize it from trans to cis, and then rotate around these bonds so that it has this structure. Now, I wanted to put it in that structure for a special reason. Can anybody guess what that reason is? Derek? Right, because now we can do the same reaction again with this alkene doing the SN2 and displacing pyrophosphate. So we can form a ring as a cation. Of course, the electrons went away here. So we got a cation there. And now what can that cation can do? It can lose a proton. You'd expect the most stable form would be to lose the proton here to get the heavily substituted one. But sometimes under biological control it loses this one and gets this compound which is called limonene. Why did I make it green? Yeah, it's lemongrass oil. Limon is lemon, right? So lemongrass oil is that stuff. It smells like lemons. Okay, now, or I could draw this differently. Instead of drawing it that way, I could bend this up into an axial position on the six-membered ring. Why did I do that? Because now this cation can attack that double bond. Okay, now where should it attack? Should it attack this carbon or this more substituted carbon? Where should a cation attack an alkene, Mike? Should attack the less substituted and give the more substituted cation. Okay, that's Markovnikov addition. So you could do that. And then you could lose a proton from this, right, to make a double bond. And that's pinene. That's the scent of pine. That's what you get in, that's the major constituent of turpentine. Okay? Or, under biological control, you can do anti-Markovnikov attack on the double bond to generate the less substituted, the secondary cation. Okay? And if you do that, you can add water and lose a proton to convert the cation to an alcohol. And then if you oxidize that alcohol to a ketone, it's camphor. Right? So these things are called essential oils. They're called terpene essential oils. Terpenes because of their relation to turpentine. Right? And essential. Why do you think they're essential? Do you have to have them in your daily life, you think? I mean, they make things smell good. But why do you call them essential oils? Yeah? No? The essence is the smell. Right? So they're oils that contribute smell. So a lot of perfumes and so on are involve terpenes. Now notice a terpene, all these things are C10. Remember geraniol was also a terpene, the thing that we started from here. If you just used water to displace this and got the alcohol, you have the essence of geranium. Okay, so C10 is called a terpene. Now, if you take geraniol pyrophosphate and attack it with another one, right? Now you get the thing called farnesyl pyrophosphate. How many carbons? 15. Okay, so those things are called sesquiterpenes. You know what sesqui means, like sesquicentennial? It means 1.5. So if a terpene is 10, a sesquiterpene is 15. So there are lots of essential oils that are sesquiterpenes too, like caryophyllene, which is in the cloves or hemp. In fact, there's up to 30% of that in the flowers of cannabis sativa, I read on the Wikipedia. Okay, and rosemary has that one too. So that's a sesquiterpene. Okay, but now two of these farnesyl pyrophosphates can come together in a different, more complicated way. Right, so this is not the same reaction, and I'm not going to talk about it. This is head-to-head. Notice these are all head-to-tail. You keep adding the same way every time. But now two of them come together head-to-head, form a bond with reduction, and give this, which is shark liver oil, or squalene. And there's the new bond, okay, right in the middle. Okay, and that then is C30. So these things are called triterpenes. Now, triterpenes are important. Let's look at a particular class of them here, where I've coiled squalene around in a very funny way, but for a purpose that you'll understand. And you can imagine that some enzyme might be able to coil it around in this way to do the reactions. Okay, now the first thing that happens is that oxygen is given to make an epoxide. We've talked about making epoxides. The enzyme makes the oxygen selective. So there are all these double bonds that could have been attacked. All of them are tri-substituted. They look like they should be about the same reactivity. But the enzyme is able to make it attack just this one at the end. Okay. Now, what do you do with epoxides? What did we do with epoxides before? Why do they make, 20 zillion tons a year of ethylene oxide? Do you want epoxides? You open them up, right? How do you open it? What reagent do you use? Good. It's still a week until our next exam, so don't worry. But it's good to keep up, okay? So we do that. Now, what's this going to do? Now the alkene will attack. In fact, the alkene could have attacked to help open the ring. Right? So now we got a tertiary cation, and that looks good. What next? What next? Those are Markovnikov additions, right? Next, you would expect it to attack here to give this tertiary cation in a five-membered ring. But the enzyme doesn't want that. It holds it so it does an anti-Markovnikov addition and gives a secondary cation. And next? Okay. And you can imagine this one then getting into the act, right? But it doesn't, right? It does sometimes in other cases, but not in this case. It stops there, okay? So now we've got these four rings, 6-6-6 five-membered ring. And now it starts doing rearrangements. Can you see a rearrangement that might happen? This is already a tertiary cation. So you can rearrange, remember, by moving something bonded to the next carbon, like a carbon or a hydrogen, a hydride can shift. Right, but you don't want to get less stable than a tertiary cation. So you don't want to make a hydrogen that's here, say, move over and change the tertiary cation to a secondary cation. Yeah.
Could you move the hydrogen below it?
The one below it is on a tertiary center. You're right, Sharif. So that's tertiary. We could shift that hydride. Incidentally, I spend lots of time making these curved arrows right. And I don't stress it enough to you how important it is to make the curved arrow start where the electrons start and end where they end, right? So it started between the carbon and this H, and it ends between this H and this carbon to make that bond, right? So be careful in drawing your curved arrows. Okay, so we got that. Any ideas for something to happen next? Brian? The hydride to the left, okay? Next. Methide, right, with its electrons. Next. Ela?
The next one,
what?
Methyl, a radical.
Methide, right, with its electrons. Next. What's next? Hydride looks good, but it doesn't happen. Okay, we ran out of luck. Okay, not this time. Okay, what happens this time is that you just lose the proton. So instead of drawing the curved arrow like this, I'm going to draw it like that. Right? It goes in to make a carbon-carbon double bond, and you lose the proton. That one could then attack another epoxide, conceivably. But you wouldn't know, because protons exchange so rapidly with water that protons go all over the place. Okay, now this thing is called lanosterol, and it's the original source of cholesterol, and all the steroid hormones are made first by making lanosterol and then modifying it. So it all comes as, it's a triterpene, right? It all came originally from isopentenyl pyrophosphate. A C30 triterpene. Okay, now this is a cute story. I led you on, and you said this. But how do you know that happens? Right? It may make it. Some may make it from CO2 or from I don't know, from whatever, from hair. Okay, but it's a cute story. But is it true? Right? And you're going to have to be patient on this one. But when we get to NMR in a couple weeks, then I'll show you how you know that these rearrangements actually happen that way. Okay, now, just schematically, not talking about mechanism, isopentenyl pyrophosphate is a little bit like isoprene. It's five carbons, the butadiene with an extra methyl group on it. And then it has a leaving group on here instead of the double bond. Okay, but schematically we can imagine that what happens, just, I gave this talk once to friends of the Grove Street Cemetery, okay, and I didn't want to go into curved arrows with them, so I used arrows like this and showed that you could make bonds on the end. So if you have two isoprenes, you can break them apart and get this, and that's familiar to you, that's geraniol, a dimer, C10. Okay, or you could take two isoprenes like this and make this one, which is a different form of the kind we saw before, right? This is menthol. Okay, or you could take four isoprenes. We didn't talk. This is a diterpene, right? And put them together like that. And this one is retinal, right? Which is what makes your eyes sense color, okay? Or sense light altogether, right? And if you take 30,000 isoprenes and put them together, right? Then you get latex. Right? Now, where does latex come from? Who puts 30,000 together? Milkweed does. Right? But a more practical one is Hevea brasiliensis, this tree, the rubber tree, which you can tap and get this latex into a bag and then sell it to your neighbor. Now, I was going to show you this here. Let's see if this will work. Now, why do we not see anything here? This should be showing up on the document camera. Why can't I see this? Oh, it's not focused. That's the trouble. Let's zoom. I was zoomed in too far. Oh, it's upside down. Rotate. Okay. So here's latex. You can buy it to mold rubber with. I bought it a year ago, so it started to get hard. But it still will flow. I haven't tried it yet this year, so I hope it works. It probably doesn't work as well as it does when it's fresh. Take my jacket off for this. Thank you. This is messier than when it's fresh. I can't get the paper towel off. All right, let's see. Okay, so here's a rubber ball. Right, there you go. Okay, so rubber. You're welcome. Yeah. Okay. Now, here's the stuff we use. There's some rubber balls we made a while ago. Okay, now, when this was brought to the old world, people tried to figure out how to use it. So Thomas Hancock devised a thing to break it up, to masticate it, as he called it. And Charles McIntosh in Scotland sandwiched rubber between layers to make waterproof garments. What do they call them in England? McIntoshes, right? They're raincoats. But there's a trouble with this, because it got really gooey when it was hot and brittle when it was cold. So there was an entrepreneur who made a whole bunch of raincoats and put them in the closet. In the summer, they were just one gooey mass. Okay, no good. But then Charles Goodyear came along, who was a native of New Haven. Right? And in 1839, he discovered vulcanization. And he discovered it here by accident. Right? And here's his account. He wrote a book called Gum Elastic. He was really fascinated by gum elastic, by latex. And this book he published, there's a copy in the Beinecke, but the original copy was printed on rubber. He wanted to find all sorts of things you could do with rubber, and it became a single gooey mass in the long run. Okay, but anyhow, in recounting how he made this discovery, he said he, talking about himself, was surprised to find that the specimen, being carelessly brought into contact with a hot stove, charred like leather. Right? He endeavored to call the attention of his brother, as well as some other individuals who were present and who were acquainted with the manufacture of gum elastic, to this effect, as remarkable and unlike any before known, since gum elastic always melted when exposed to a high degree of heat instead of charring. Right? The occurrence did not at the time seem to them to be worthy of notice. It was considered as one of the frequent appeals that he was in the habit of making in behalf of some new experiment. Okay, so he was an enthusiast, and people were accustomed to that. But he showed it to Benjamin Silliman, whose statue you walk by out here, who wrote in 1839, "Having seen experiments made and also performed them myself with the India rubber prepared by Mr. Charles Goodyear, I can state that it does not melt, but rather chars by heat, and that it does not stiffen by cold, but retains its flexibility with cold, even when laid between cakes of ice." So Goodyear made rubber practical. Now, what was the mistake, or what did he do to make this discovery? He had the idea of putting something like talcum powder on the rubber to keep it from getting sticky. So he thought of using sulfur, powdered sulfur. And he accidentally dropped some of the stuff that had powdered sulfur on it onto a stove, and it became this stuff that was much better, improved in its properties. And then he patented it here in 1844, and he says, I do claim the combining of said gum with sulfur and with white lead, the white lead's not essential, so as to form a triple compound. Of course, 1844, who knew from compound, right? This was before there were even bonds. Right, 1858 was the discovery of bonds. In combination with the foregoing, the process of exposing India rubber fabric to the action of a high degree of heat, such as is herein specified, by means of which the improved compound is effectually changed in its properties so as to protect it from decomposition or deterioration. So in 1851 here, 7 years after the patent, is the big Crystal Palace demonstration of 19th century technology in London. And in the U.S. Pavilion, the featured thing was a big pile of rubber in this Goodyear's vulcanite court. And here in it were things made of rubber. For example, this table, which you can see in a museum up just north of here, a desk made out of India rubber, all sorts of things. He had his portrait painted on India rubber. That portrait is still there, too. Okay, so what happens? What does vulcanization do? So you take latex polymer, or several molecules of latex polymer, and somehow vulcanization joins adjacent chains with what are called cross-links. Now, there are probably lots of different cross-links, and I don't know, nobody knows exactly what happens when you drop it on a stove. But perhaps it's radical addition and allylic substitution. So there, if you pulled off a hydrogen there, you'd get an allylic radical, which would be stabilized by resonance, right? And you can imagine it adding to, for example, H2S. You could imagine getting this. You can imagine that HS adding to the next alkene by a radical or conceivably an ionic mechanism, probably radical mechanism. And I don't know whether the bridge is S or two S's or something else. But anyhow, that's the idea, is that it makes bridges between the chains. So now we're going to talk just a little bit about how vulcanization changes the physical properties of polymers. And we're going to do it by another experiment, or by repeating an experiment, which was done in 1803 and communicated in this description of a property of caoutchouc, or India rubber, with some reflections on the cause of electricity, of elasticity of the substance. A letter written by John Gough, who, this thing about John Gough was written by Wordsworth. He was blind, John Gough, but a great naturalist, as Wordsworth says here. Okay. But he was a great scientist as well. He said, "The substance called caoutchouc, or Indian rubber, possesses a singular property which I believe has never been taken notice of in print, at least not by any English writer." So here's the first paper, and you can read it at your leisure, but the part I want to talk about is here. He said, "I made a piece of caoutchouc a little heavier than an equal bulk of water, so it would sink, the temperature of which was 45 degrees. The vessel contained the resin and water, was then placed on the fire, and when the contents of it were heated to 130 degrees, the caoutchouc floated. So originally it sank, and now it floated, right? So it became less dense than water. Water, of course, also expands on warming, but caoutchouc must expand more to become what was more dense, less dense. So heating rubber makes it expand more than water expands. Okay, that's observation one. Now here's experiment, what he calls experiment one. He says, hold one end of the slip thus prepared, so we're going to do that, if you have your balloon. Okay. If you guys, there are balloons over there for those who didn't get them. Okay. So just take the neck of the balloon where it's thinnest, like this. And he says, between thumb and forefinger of each hand, bring the middle of the piece into slight contact with the edges of the lips. Your upper lip is like this, okay? Okay? Taking care to keep it straight all the time and not to stretch it much beyond its natural length. After taking these preparatory steps, extend the slip suddenly. What did he perceive? Do it really quick. And as far hard as you can. Not a wimpy one. Come on, Christine. Really let it have it. Let it have it. What do you notice? It gets hot. Okay, so you will immediately perceive that it gets hot. Okay, why do you think it gets hot? Friction. Good idea. Okay. Now here's experiment two. One end of a slip of caoutchouc be fastened to a rod of metal or wood. So we're going to try this again if we can here. See if we can. So we've got this balloon here, stretched, and if I can see it. Okay, now we see that. Let's here get something white out here behind it. Okay, so there's a heavy weight stretching this piece of rubber here. And now I'm going to heat it. Isn't that what he says to do? And a weight be fixed to the other extremity in order to keep it in a vertical position. The thong will, okay, now we're going to, now what he did was heat it. Now what's going to happen when I heat it? Let me get it next to the scale here so you can see that red line. So the black, the weight's just at the top of the red line. What's going to happen if I heat it? What? Will the black thing stay there? What will it do? Drop. Okay, let's try. Has it moved at all? Is it moving at all? Let me try taking it away. So I'm going to cool it now. What happened when I cooled it? Now let me heat it. What happens when I heat and cool? It stretches when it cools. No, it stretches when it cools, right? And contracts when it heats. So John Guff was, blind though he was making some pretty interesting observations. Okay, so heating tightly... Remember, we already saw that heating rubber makes it expand, right? It floated when it sank before. Now heating rubber, once it's been tightly stretched, makes it contract. It's the opposite. What the heck is going on? Now, back to the question about the heating that we observed. If stretching rubber generates heat, what should letting it contract do? Suppose Derek's right. Suppose it's friction. What happens when you let it come back? What? No. If you let it come back, it's still friction. They rub against one another when you pull them out. They rub against one another when they go back. So it should heat both ways. Right? Everybody see what I'm saying? Okay, if heat comes from internal friction, contraction should also cause friction, right? But if heat comes from some other cause, the contraction may do the opposite. Okay, so now what we're going to do is going to do like this and generate heat. Hold it really tightly stretched and go like this to bring it back to room temperature. While tightly stretched, really put your muscles into it, Christine, this time, okay? Now put it against your lip and then let it quickly contract.
Oh my God.
So is it friction? It's something else going on. Why? There we go. Okay, now if Goodyear had wondered about this, here's Klein Tower, right? Here we are, right here. And this is in the Grove Street Cemetery. And who do you see? Goodyear. Okay, if he had really wondered about this, he could have asked the neighbor, right? Because here's Goodyear, and if you go to that thing there, and then from that down here, you find this guy, right? J. Willard Gibbs, right? There's no indication they ever met, actually, right? Although they overlapped a little bit in their time, but Gibbs would have been very young. Okay, or you could have gone across to these two guys here. And these are Kirkwood and Onsager, who were the principal theoretical chemists of the mid-19th century. In fact, Onsager, as you can see, well, you'll see here. This is Kirkwood's gravestone. And you can see that there's quite a bit of detail here about Kirkwood's accomplishments. Now, Kirkwood and Onsager were the best of friends, right? But their wives weren't particularly congenial, I believe. Because when Onsager died, and at his request was buried shoulder to shoulder with Kirkwood, this is the gravestone that his wife chose for him. Nobel laureate. And then she died 15 years later, roughly, and was buried in the same grave, so they carved it so that their children had it recarved and put her name on, and also added an asterisk.
Oh,
Okay. But anyhow, any of these guys could have explained to Goodyear what was going on with this stuff. And this is it. It has to do with statistics. Okay, so suppose you have a stretched chain, right? There's only one arrangement that has maximum length. When you really, really, really stretch it out as hard as you can, only one way to have the chain, right? But if you shorten the chain, then you can have that arrangement or that one or that one or that one or that one or that one. So entropy is really in favor of having shorter distance end to end. Okay? So if you have a whole bunch of them in a polymer and you stretch it, the chains have lots and lots of different ways of being, and then fewer and fewer ways of doing the arrangement. And finally, when at the very end of stretching, this is why I asked Christine to really put her muscles into it, right? At the very end, when you get it as strong as it can, then it will crystallize locally. But notice when you do this that the heat only happens right at the end. You agree with me? It's only right at the end that the heat happens. That's when it crystallizes locally. Okay, so that crystallization makes it more rigid. So that affects the polymer properties. But also, it makes it release heat when it crystallizes. Okay? But now, if it absorbs heat, that melts the crystals. Right? And makes them shorten, makes the chain shorten. Right? So the statistics will then bring it back, not going to lower energy, but going to higher entropy. Right? The low energy form, the one that has released heat, is when it's crystallized and way stretched. But statistics would like it to be the other way and to absorb heat. Okay. But if you have cross links between adjacent chains, it'll prevent crystallization and brittleness in the cold. So it won't crystallize if the chains can't line up well, so it won't become as brittle, right? And now, how do you make a tangle flow? How do you unscramble spaghetti? How can you have spaghetti flow, right? There's a thing called lengthwise motion by reptation. Reptation is in reptile, how a reptile moves. Right? So here it is. Suppose you want to move that chain out, move that chain along. What you do is you push it. It's like pushing a carpet. You make a wrinkle in it and then move the wrinkle along, because the whole thing is so tangled up you can't make it move relative to its neighbors. But you can move a wrinkle along and it'll go all the way along the chain, right? All the way until it comes out to the end here, and now it'll have a wrinkle there, and then finally that end can move. So it can move by coming in here and out here and then dig itself a new tunnel of a different shape. So that's how polymers change shape, right? By this reptation thing. So changing shape by snaking along a tunnel through the tangled neighbors, right? But if you have cross links, then you can't do that. Right? You can't do the reptation. It'll stop when it gets to a cross link. And that's what vulcanization does to make it harder. So it now it won't flow when it's hot. So it won't be gooey and change its shape when it's hot. And it won't crystallize when it's cold, because the chains can't line up next to one another, so it's not brittle. So that then makes rubber useful. Okay? Now, I'll stop now. This is part of it, but vulcanization in the home is the next topic, about people who vulcanize themselves. Okay, that's it for today.